the idea that someone reached for someone when they truly think that this player is going to be better than what many other people think are going to be better players, it's not truly a reach, right? But we do reach. There's times where you took a player or you paid an extra $2 for someone and you look back and you're like, what was I doing? Or you knew as soon as it happens that you didn't take the player for a reason that you had them the highest. You actually went down your list a little bit to take that player, right? Or you went that, or you added a few extra dollars to that dollar value that you had assigned to that player once you'd adjusted for the inflation, you know, at the time. So when that happens, that's a reach, but that's, in my opinion, so the first reach that we discussed where you're following your actual valuations, that's not a reach and it's not a mistake.
And welcome to episode 82 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I'm George Bissell of Baseball Prospectus. Brett Sayer and Mike Gianella are off this week. They're busy prepping for the Tout Wars auctions coming up this weekend in New York City. We're going to be recording some content in New York. Very excited. That's going to be coming up next week. We'll recap Tout Wars as well and all the action from the Big Apple. But coming up on this edition of Flags Fly Forever, my conversation with Jeff Quinn of Baseball Prospectus. We're going to talk draft strategy, valuations, process-driven fantasy baseball strategy. It's stuff that everybody can apply to their own leagues. It's great stuff, and that's coming your way next. First, a little housekeeping. You can follow me on Twitter at George Bissell. Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. If you haven't done that already, please go do so. Every review, every rating helps us out tremendously. So we appreciate it. We get great support from everybody who listens to the show. So I want to thank everybody for that. And stay tuned after the break. Coming up, a conversation with Jeff Quinton of Baseball Prospectus talking draft strategy. If you haven't had your draft already, if you didn't have it this past weekend, it's coming up. You got to get ready. Here's some food for thought, some fantasy baseball food for thought for your draft coming up after the break. We'll be right back here on Flags Fly Forever. Welcome to a special edition of Flags Fly Forever. I'm George Bissell of Baseball Prospectus. Joining me to talk fantasy baseball strategy is one of my favorite writers. It's Jeff Quinton of Baseball Prospectus. You can follow him on Twitter at JJQ01. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, George. Great to be here.
Your articles at BP stress the importance of process over results when it comes to fantasy baseball. And I think a good way to start out our discussion would be for you to quickly summarize what exactly that means and why process is the foundation over everything associated with building a fantasy roster. You don't want to focus on the results. It comes down to the process that matters more than anything.
Yeah. And I think this is when it comes to process and results, dealing with the future, at least for, I guess, how our minds work or how our brains work. And I'm not an expert in any of this, but what a lot of people who are more expert at it say is we struggle with it, right? All we're trying to do is make the world make sense to us in a way. So results are something we can grab onto. They're easy. They're easy to make decisions off of because we know they happened. But with any event, there's all kinds of non-events that could have happened, right? So what you want to be able to do is take a look at not just your results, but what got you those results. Was it luck? And we know that we tend to we tend to assign luck to the success of others more than we assign it to our own success, which should say something about generally how we value results. We're probably, we use the term bias probably a lot, but we're biased towards things that make us look good. And the danger is that, you know, it keeps us happy being able to think like that, but in order for us to make better decisions going forward, which is all we ever want to do, you know, you're not making the best baseball team for last season or the best team that you can defend the decisions you made based off what's happened in the past. We're trying to make decisions that give us the best chance of winning in the future. And in order to do that, you need to not only understand, you know, the amount of luck involved with any of the results you've gotten, but understand the process that got you to those decisions.
I think one of the traps that fantasy owners fall into is when they've had success doing the same thing over and over again, you're very reluctant to change that process. It may be a flawed process, but you've just had success over and over again. And one of the things I think you've talked about a bunch with your articles is that don't be afraid to embrace change, and that doing the same thing over and over again, that can actually really hurt you in the long run, especially if your league mates catch on to what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that not just fantasy baseball participants have trouble with. This is something that businesses have trouble with, in that being successful, it gets more and more expensive to be successful, or it gets less and less lucrative to be successful the same way or in the same manner over and over again. Because as soon as you're successful doing something, or certain people are successful doing something, people take notice. There's a reason why a lot of baseball teams are far more interested in contact hitting and especially outfield defense than they were before. It's because they noticed the Royals be getting good results from valuing those things. And in fantasy baseball, it's the same way. There's also a great thing called the advocacy bias. So the more we implement something, or the more we advocate for something or defend something, usually we might defend our actions to others, but it's also generally justifying our actions to ourselves. The more strongly we begin to feel about certain things, and it's not that difficult to see how we do that with players. You'll see that I might take, we were talking about this earlier off the podcast, Dellin Betances is someone that I'm a player that I think is being underdrafted right now or undervalued right now. But the fact that I got him what I thought was a good value, maybe at the 180 mark in a mixed league draft, now that I've written about it and talked about it, now I'll start to reach more and more to get that bargain. And what happens then? It's less and less of a bargain. So that's when it comes down to, it's okay to understand why you're successful and to be able to make decisions from that and, you know, emulate that success, but you also have to know when that success isn't worth the cost anymore.
That's a great example when you brought up Betances, because we're talking a little bit abstractly here about strategy and process. And a lot of people might be wondering, listening to this, going, well, how can I apply that to my league? And I think Betances is a great example, because just because you had success drafting Betances this year doesn't mean that you should go out and either get him again next year, or a player with a similar profile. The value might not necessarily be the same next year on that type of a guy, especially if the rest of the league starts to invest in that type of a profile as well. So I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, there's another thing with that I think is interesting. It's become an idea that I've become kind of obsessed with of late, and it's the idea of our ability of making decisions based off of the imaginable. So what we're able to imagine something working that's worked in the past. That's one reason why we repeat from our past successes, or we avoid our past failures, because it's so easily imaginable. And then with certain players, I think when the success is easily imaginable, this guy's going to move me up 5 spots in saves, or this guy's going to move me up 3 spots in strikeouts because he's going to get 200 strikeouts. That's easy. But some players, like a Dellin Betances, or like a player who has a less certain or more abnormal role, it's harder to say, oh, this guy's going to move me X amount of spots in whip and ERA, or this guy's going to move me this amount of spots in run scored. It's hard for us to think like that.
I wanted to get to this a little bit later, but you kind of touched on it and you've brought it up a little earlier as well. But our ability to evaluate upside, you kind of touched on it there in terms of we want to see the best case scenario. We fall into a trap where we believe that a player will exceed a reasonable statistical projection that we may put down on a piece of paper. And a good example of that, I think for me, I'd be a little biased. I'd say that a guy like Billy Hamilton is a good personification of that, because while I can reasonably project him for, let's say, 55, 60 steals, I think that's a fair baseline. There's a scenario in which his upside is he could steal 80 bases. It's hard to gauge that, and you see it in several other guys, like Miguel Sano, Kyle Schwarber, Carlos Correa, especially with young players. So what's the biggest challenge, at least in your mind, in terms of how we value upside and how we should account for that in our draft strategy? Because I think that's one of the more compelling questions in all of fantasy baseball.
Yeah, and this is something that I think is particularly interesting. It's actually one of the first things I wrote, about at Baseball Prospectus, was it's about prospect theory, and it's the idea that we value upside and we value security or safety or reliability differently at different times based off of the decision we face. So if we wanted to look, you'll notice some people are higher on one guy than another, but there's times where people will say, oh, in the ninth round, when all the options are starting to not look as helpful or as beneficial as the eight before it, you know, the players are starting to show significant flaws, let's say, that's when we can start reaching. Or with the number eight pick, after the first seven are locked, you know, whatever it happens to be in a given year, we start saying, oh, well, that's when you could take the guy that you really like, because he's got the upside to be a top five player. And what you're doing at that point, in either of those situations that I just described, is you're framing the situation through expectation. So I expect in my first round pick to be able to have a guy who could be a top five player. I expect with my ninth pick to have a player that can still be a top 100 player. But what you're not doing, and this is what we want to do with every decision, is we want to make the best bet possible. We want to get the best odds every single time. And sometimes the best odds are a 99% chance at a guy with $10. Actually, that's never the case, but for example's sake, right? And sometimes the best odds are a guy with a 10% chance at $30, right? And a 90% chance at $4.
Yeah, especially in the late rounds. Right. I see that a lot.
So the idea is that you always want to be thinking about what's the expected value of this player, all things considered. And you want to do that with every decision. Not, oh, well, I like any of these guys, so I want to take the safest guy because they all seem satisfactory to me. Well, you could be leaving potentially, you know, $8 of expected value on the table because the guy that's a little riskier is really a better player because if his upside hits, it's that much better. Or conversely, at the end of the draft, when you say, oh man, this guy, he's got a chance. I got a chance to get this really good player, you know, this $20 player or a guy who could be a top 200 player, you know, in the last round of my deep mix draft. Well, you might be leaving a guy on the table who's a lock to be a top 300 player. And even though he's got no shot at being the top, you know, top 100 guy, the other guy does, the way that his expected value works out is that this guy's your best bet to provide value for you the rest of the year.
Yeah, that's a great point. I want to get a little further into value from the sense of, you know, if you do a draft, whether it's online or in person, the number one thing you're guaranteed to hear whenever someone makes a pick, oh man, that was a great value. And I cringe a little bit because I think our application of value is wrong in some sense, because it's subjective. Okay, one person's value, you touched on it. Some, you may have a player valued in your rankings or your auction values. Let's say you have him valued as a ninth round pick, and you know someone may take him in the ninth round, and you think, man, that's a great value. But someone else, they may have him as a 13th round guy. And it's all subjective. So I want to get your thoughts as to whether we're, I don't want to say we're using it incorrectly, but is our understanding of value a little bit flawed just because we've become so obsessed with it as an industry and as fantasy owners that I don't think we're really applying it correctly to situations when we look at the decisions we're making on drafts?
Yeah. So, I mean, off the cusp, I think there's a couple things with that statement. I think one thing we have to be careful with is the, when we say that's a great value, I think we tend to get in this idea of, at least in like in an auction, we'll say we're obsessed with getting a player that's worth more than the dollar amount, right? So like a $4 guy that's worth $6, but any $1 guy is probably going to be worth more than $1 throughout the draft. That's not really the value you're looking for, because there's a player that might be worth $0, but has a 50% chance of being worth $10. And if you left that on the table for the lock for $3, then you made a bad choice, right? So I think there's that where it's, there's a little bit of anchoring on whatever the auction value is. And we do the same thing in drafts with a ranking of, all right, everyone had Todd Frazier as, you know, a top 40 player, let's say, and you got him at 55 and everyone says great value. Now that might actually be a great value, but there's actually something called, it's called wisdom of the crowds. So it's that if you took at any point, you know, you could take a bunch of people and ask them for evaluation of what they think, you know, something's expected to be in the future, right? Generally, what ends up happening is that what the true value or the true expected value of that risky asset is the median or the mean of that of those guesses, so to speak. So when everyone's low on someone for a particular reason, then maybe the person getting that person getting the player left over maybe isn't getting that value. And that's the tricky part, is how do you weigh when the crowd is wrong? Because that's the real value, right? When is the player, when is the market really misvaluing something? And maybe they're misvaluing Todd Frazier because they're so scared of that second half, right? Or maybe they're misvaluing, we'll go back to Betances, because they don't, they can't see how his production gets to be so productive for your teams, right? And that's what I'm trying to drive at, is trying to find the values where we can say there's a reason why this is happening, not just maybe the crowd is speaking a little bit to what this person's true value is.
So let's look at your most recent piece. You wrote about reaching and how it's sort of a little bit of a fallacy in terms of it doesn't really exist in the sense that we think of it. What's your stance on reaching, and sort of explain why, in your opinion, it's not as big of a deal as maybe we think it is?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first thing, and you kind of touched on this in your last question, was that reaching is not, we all have, I guess we all have our own personal valuations, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's a little bit of game theory involved, where if I know I am 10 rounds higher on Jerod Dyson than anyone else, then, or whoever, player, whoever, then I don't need to draft him 10 rounds earlier. I could draft him, you know, 5 rounds earlier, or 2 rounds earlier than everyone else. Each round I pass on my actual value, you give up a little bit of risk, because someone else might be higher on them. But the idea is that it's not a reach if you're following the expected value you think you're going to get from the player, right? Assuming, and this is an assumption that's always false, that you've removed whatever biases you can from your process. So the idea that someone reached for someone when they truly think that this player is going to be better than what many other people think are going to be better players, it's not truly a reach, right?
Yeah.
But we do reach. There's times where you took a player or you paid an extra $2 for someone and you look back and you're like, what was I doing? Or you knew as soon as it happens that you didn't take the player for a reason that you had them the highest. You actually went down your list a little bit to take that player, right? or you went or you added a few extra dollars to that dollar value that you had assigned to that player once you'd adjusted for the inflation, you know, at the time. So when that happens, that's a reach, but that's, in my opinion, so the first reach that we discussed where you're following your actual valuations, that's not a reach and it's not a mistake.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is there a difference between trusting your values and your projections, trusting your process, and actually actively reaching, which is deviating from that process?
Yes. When you're following your own valuations and those valuations don't align with the rest of the people in your draft room or at your auction, isn't a reach. That's you making the best bet possible. But when you take a player because you think, oh, I need, for some reason other than value, that's what I would call a reach. So when you've, in my opinion, when you misframe a decision because you need to get a top X shortstop because you need some stability in your starting rotation, that's when I think you're reaching, is when you're not making the best bet possible, when you're using some other mechanism or some other reason to make a decision. Something else is driving that decision other than value. And it happens all the time. It happens to me all the time. And all we could try to do is minimize it.
I think you see it a lot in the late rounds where people are like, well, the best player on my board was, let's say, Evan Gattis, but I took the random pitcher in the late rounds because I needed a pitcher. So I think you see that a lot more.
Oh, yeah. How many people do you think are kicking themselves for reaching for some high upside middle infielder going into last year instead of taking boring Brandon Crawford?
That's very true. Right? I had this experience.
Yep. It happens all the time. Or conversely, how much do you think reaching helped people who took a player who was the last good player or safe player at their position? JJ Hardy at shortstop 3 years ago was going in like the fifth round sometimes because you could bank on power from the shortstop position.
I think we fall into a trap too, where we think that what's just happened is most likely to happen again. I think a good example this year is someone like Marcelo Ozuna. We get a lot of questions at BP about him, and a lot of fantasy owners go, well, how can you still rank him so high? He was terrible last year. And it's like, well, you have to understand, he was really good in 2014 at 23 years old. He was hitting, I think he hit close to 25 home runs. And
right,
you can't assume that this goes back to recency bias, but you can't assume that what we just saw is going to happen again. That's someone like Miguel Sano or Chris Bryant, that they're going to build off of what they did last year. There's a reasonable chance. I mean, you see it all the time. Development is not linear, especially with young players. They're more likely in some cases to take a step back than they are to take another one forward. So I think that's something we fall into a trap a little bit about too with young players.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about, or really I've been talking a lot about value. And I think that's where the real value comes in, is there's a great expectation among people that the same thing will happen year over year, or that's most likely to happen. And how many players do we see have a bad year and then a good year, or a good year than a bad year? Like, every player, right?
All the time.
Almost, right? So
except for Mookie Betts.
50% of the players. Really good.
Mookie Betts is the exception. He just continues to get better.
And that's hey, don't jinx Mookie.
I know.
But, so it's the point of that, though, is that if the players are just going to repeat or do what we just saw them do, there'd be no point of even playing fantasy baseball, right? Because then we would just like pick based on the stats last year, and that would be it. I mean, except to eat like buffalo wings on draft day, but
which is pretty fun.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Or a good bagel, whitefish spread, depending on, you know, what your draft or auctions deal is. But or whatever. But the point of this is that and then that gets back to your original question of process versus results. And I think the biggest thing is that we don't appreciate how, yes, these decisions are largely unimportant in the grand scheme of life, but that doesn't mean that they're not incredibly difficult, right?
Yeah.
We're trying not only to deal with, we don't even have a probabilistic future. We don't even know what the odds are. We're taking our best guess at what the odds are for these players, different possible outcomes that they could produce. And when you get something that complex, and then you could choose between all these different positions, and you have league construct, and you have league norm going on, and you have league norms affecting your decisions, we start to settle on different shortcuts to help us figure that out. So maybe it's the player that helped us last year. Maybe it's how the player performed last year. Maybe it's the ranking that we're seeing on the website that we're using. The guy that we've seen should have gone 10 picks ago per, you know, whatever website's algorithm, however they do their values. And that's where we get into trouble. That's kind of the, as Daniel Kahneman would call, that's the type one thinking. That's how you make decisions to just get through your day, right? What size coffee do you want to order today? Do you want to stop at gas on your way to work or on your way back? Who do you copy on an email? That's stuff that you don't want to spend a lot of time thinking of, or you don't want to put in rigorous analysis. But when it comes to making a decision, when you only have 23 or 30 decisions that are all dictate your success in, you know, this game for the rest of the season, or they might be your 30 most important decisions, that's when you want to try to take out all those shortcuts and get back to how am I going to be able to amass the best odds possible for my players to produce the most.
So let's talk a little bit about draft strategy, because that's what everyone's concerned about. Draft season's heating up. Everyone's doing mock drafts. They're getting insane values in the late rounds. One of the things you've written about recently and throughout your time at BP, you've written about strategic agility, which is basically the ability to change course in order to take advantage of dynamic conditions. And for me, at least when I look at draft strategy overall, I found that the best fantasy owners, especially when you look at the expert leagues, whether it's Labor or Tout Wars, they all go into the draft with the exact same sort of mantra and process. And that's that they don't really have one. They let the draft play out and they're able to make adjustments on the fly. And I think that ability to recognize trends as they're happening and make adjustments is really the most important thing. Is that sort of a correct overview of what you're talking about when you write about strategic agility?
Yeah, I think so. I think what it comes down to, and I mean, this, we touched on this earlier, is when we talked about past success and people copying past success and that making it a less successful process or strategy going forward, is that when we go into draft prep, right, you're figuring out your rankings, you're figuring out what you kind of, you're imagining how you want your team to look based on the values you think you're going to see. But the issue is that we're not smarter than everyone else, right? Or we're not as much smarter than everyone else as we think. And so the point of that is that the great idea that we tend to have, oh, I'm going to wait on and only take $2 $1 catchers, or oh, I'm going to wait late to fill my outfield because I think outfield's deeper, whatever it is, someone else is probably going to have that idea as well. And that makes your strategy that you're going to employ probably not going to be as successful, because now you're fighting someone else for that same strategy. And I think that's been the big thing that I've learned as I've done more drafts and more auctions, is you need to go in with some kind of strategy, because otherwise, or some kind of idea of what you think you want to do, because it gives you scope, or it gives you an idea of kind of how you think people are thinking about certain players. But what you need to be able to do is then revise that thinking, because you might think that the top pitcher is going to go for $25 or going to go in the second round, or, you know, after Kershaw, you know, the second round or whatever it is. And then that could drastically change. It could be way later or way earlier. And the people that can then make adjustments to that, the people who can do that second level of strategy, where instead of just, I'm going to get the two guys that I'm going to get Ben Revere and Billy Hamilton and steal all the bases and win, right? Like, sure, that's fine. You have to pay a lot to do that. And then everyone else scrambling to get steals in the middle rounds because of that. Well, if you can say, all right, well, steals are just not going to be a value in this draft right now. I'm going to go take all the value that everyone's leaving elsewhere. That's how it works. And really, so the idea is with strategy is businesses analyze, or anyone analyzes a situation and decides, I'm going to, this is an area that I can, I don't know if it's exploit or take advantage of or do well in, to really be, to be my most, I don't know if you want to call it profitable or the best way of accomplishing whatever goal you have, right? Mm-hmm. The difference with fantasy baseball is that the construct of the game, you can't, we're not Coca-Cola. We can't just decide what markets we want to play in, because if it's a draft, options get taken away by our opponents. If it's an auction, prices get dictated by the market, and you have to be able to always adjust to that. You can't just put your flag in the ground and say, I'm going to do this, because the rules of the game don't let you. So all you can do is let other people, you have to let, see what the decisions other people are making and react to them.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. One example you brought up, speed in the middle rounds. I was going to ask you about some trends maybe you've noticed this year that you've had to adjust to. And I've noticed this in my own drafts. And it's a guy you've written about a little bit is Byron Buxton. And he fits into this mold. But I've seen a real emphasis on getting speed guys in the middle rounds, whether it's Denard Span, Ender Inciarte, Kevin Pillar. People are really taking notice of the fact that, you know, the reality is speed's down in the game. Seven guys stole more than 30 bases last year. It's a really valued commodity now that people are recognizing that. So I've seen people go all in and try and reach is the right word. When you look at my valuations and my rankings, I see people going above what I have on my sheet to get speed centered profiles in the middle rounds. Have you seen that as well? And if not, maybe what are some trends that you've noticed this year in your drafts or auctions that you've done so far?
Well, I think what I've always noticed is that the top echelon speed, right? The guys who could steal 50 bases, they generally always, it's hard to get them at a discount usually, because people can imagine what those 50 steals are. They know what that looks like a lot. Or maybe earlier in this offseason, we were seeing someone like Ben Revere get underrated a little bit because he had some playing time things when he changed teams last year. And it wasn't quite a top tier season from him from a stolen base standpoint. So maybe they get a little underrated here or there. What's funny, I think, is that while we might start to see people pay a premium for these stolen bases for these top guys, which is okay if you're adjusting to, you know, the new normal in stolen bases in Major League Baseball. I mean, I think that that's probably a good thing that we're valuing stolen bases a little higher than the power that's occurred over the last couple years. At least in the fantasy baseball world. But what you don't see is interesting is there's value in a guy like Eric Hosmer, who's going to steal 7 to 10 bases or 5 to 10 bases. Those steals still count. You know, Brett Lawrie's steals, handful of steals, still count. And so then that's the funny thing with our logic is that we don't extend it across everything. We only apply it to where often it's easy to apply. And in that case, it's the guys who get a lot of steals. That's who you think about with steals, but no one's docking Adrian Gonzalez because he's only going to get one steal, but maybe you should compared to maybe other first basemen who are going to steal 4 to 7 bases.
Yeah, it goes back into why you should do your own projections and your own value formula and have that a complete understanding of what a guy's worth in your scoring system. There's a lot of sites that, you know, they have the ability to do that for you PFM on Baseball Prospectus, you know, that'll do all that for you. Those are really helpful tools, and I think it's worth taking the time to do that. And don't always buy into every projection. I feel like when you see a projection, you have to go specifically buy it. If you don't agree with it, change it. It's your team. You know, it's your decisions. So don't just blindly follow a projection just because everyone believes one thing, because you might be right if you've done your own independent analysis. I want to talk about trading, because that's one element of the game where I think people are still I wouldn't say it's an inefficiency, but I feel like the people who are really good at trading, and a guy who's really good at this for me is Fred Zinke of MLB.com in the expert leagues. He's making a million trades and he just always seems to come out ahead. Do you think that trading is the one area where you can gain a real competitive advantage if you know what you're doing and you know how to work with the other owners in your league?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's the biggest, one of the biggest advantages you have, because in a draft or during your auction, everyone's involved, right? People don't sit out a couple rounds just because they're not interested, right? Everyone's always participating. But then after that, there are people that do shy away from the trade market, or if they don't trade, they're very responsive traders, right? So they only respond to offers. They're not making a lot of offers themselves. And what I've tend to see in my leagues, particularly keeper leagues, is the teams that are making a lot of trades, they're the ones that are generally tend to be more successful. And that's because, one, they're taking advantage. There's this idea that you have to win trades, right? There's this glorified notion of like, we're going to outsmart and outfox this other owner to make a trade, and we're going to get this great player for nothing, right?
Yeah, and I think the flip side of that is owners are then afraid to make trades because they don't want to be wrong. So I think that creates almost an opposite effect that you want, where some people get terrified of making a poor trade and they just shy away from making deals altogether.
Right. And it's the bigger thing is like a great trade. Yeah, sure. You know, that'll happen here and again, and it happens, right? But once in a while, but that's not a strategy of, oh, I'm going to pillage, I'm going to make the greatest trade ever, right? that's probably what's going to end up happening. If you want to make the greatest trade ever, is you're never going to make a trade.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to want to give you something for nothing. No one's interested in that. But if we can look at trades as a way that's mutually beneficial or slightly more beneficial, hey, I know this guy really likes this player or these kinds of players, and I know that I think he's undervalues or she undervalues these kinds of players, then we can take advantage of that. And that's what I talk a lot about, is one, the importance of what I call hustle or effort in the trade market. Is the more people, the more teams you can trade with, the bigger advantage, because then when you have an extra starting pitcher to move to upgrade somewhere, or an extra draft pick to move to upgrade somewhere, you have more places you could shop that, and more places you could realistically improve your team through. And that's why it's so important to try to figure out what really makes the other owners tick. And instead of when, you know, one owner trade that you've been trying to trade with and you couldn't get even a response from, or barely a response from, trades with another owner and you wish you made that trade, our first reaction is always to get upset, right? We're always upset that this person, how could you make that trade? You know, do you know what that, but again, we're looking at it through our eyes. Of course, we don't want, especially in a keeper league where things can be beneficial, like one team improves for the future, the other team improves for the past, I mean, for the now. And then every other team, you know, that's worse for every other team, right? The more times you can be that team that's taking advantage of it, the better you are. So instead of getting upset, try to figure out, why did that owner respond that way to that kind of trade? What is it that's making them do that? So some owners like to go back and forth a lot before making a trade. Some only like to receive offers and then, you know, accept one that they like. So you just got to figure that out. And the more times you can figure that out, the bigger way of improving, the more useful of a tool you have to improve your team. And I think that's a huge advantage that it's hard to write about, because it's always league specific.
Yeah.
It's always individual specific, but it's something that I think people can benefit a lot from, benefit a lot more from than putting in all the hours, you know, for your draft and auction prep. Not that you need to, but everyone else is. So that's become a need, but a way that you can improve your team with that others aren't.
One of the things we can all relate to is we all have that one person, that guy in your league who sends you just terrible offer, a barrage of terrible offers with seemingly no end game. They're also that team that never wants to give up anything and wants to get back something, I think you can, you're never going to be able to reach that person. But when you're dealing with reasonable owners, my general philosophy is you got to give up something to get something. Is that how you're approaching anytime you make a deal? Is you almost want to forget about your own team's needs for a second? Obviously, you know who you want, but you have to look at the other person's roster and say, if I were in their shoes and I'm looking at my team right here, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to get out of this transaction, or what I'm hoping to do. Because I think even if you don't meet all of their needs, I think you get them a little more closer to the edge of, you know what, I'm willing to bend a little bit on this. I'll give you maybe a little bit more than I would have initially with this deal because you worked with me a little bit. Do you think that's maybe the best way to approach trading overall as a general strategy?
Well, I think definitely the way to make more beneficial trades is to be able to see the needs of the person you're trading with, right? Because otherwise, it's just, you're just rolling dice. You're saying, hey, I want this. Maybe you want that. Maybe you want what I'm offering. That doesn't really make any sense, right? So like it's almost like the poker term. Like, it's more important to know what's in your opponent's hand than what's in your hand, right?
Yeah.
So you want to be able to see what everyone else wants. You know, the big term that you can't go, you know, a couple hours without hearing is empathy, right? But this is really an important one, is understanding what makes what someone would want in a trade is going to help you immensely. And going back to the type of trade or the type of person. So what I just learned from the question you just asked me, George, is that you're a person who likes to negotiate and talk about, you know, what you want, what I need, how can we help each other out? How can we make this deal work? And that's how I am. But I don't think in a vacuum, good or bad. I think that's just our style. Yeah. And so knowing that, that's how I would proceed in trying to make trades with you. I know a lot of owners who they want me to come up with the idea to make a trade with them.
Make me an offer guy.
Right. And then beyond that, you have the guys who, you know, they always want to win the trade that we talked about, that maybe there's not really a deal to be made with them, but there's always a deal to be made. There's not always. I didn't say always. We'll just pretend I didn't say that.
Most of the time.
But there's often a chance to make a deal when somebody wants something, right? So even if it's the owner who doesn't ever want to give anything up, who always wants to win the deal, when they want a player, when they think that this is a player they need, and that's a big one. Oh, I need this player. This player could make my team. That's the person you want to trade with. Because when someone wants something, that's generally the person who, going back to that wisdom of the crowd, they have the highest valuation of that player in the market. Now, maybe the market's all undervaluing this player, so you shouldn't move him, just keep him, right?
Yeah.
But always explore that. How far can you get with that person? How much are they really willing to give up to get what they want? And sometimes that highest end is will surprise you. And that's where you make those deals. That's when you see those deals where people start scratching their head and getting mad and saying, how did this happen? It's because you gave someone what they wanted, but the cost for them was, you know, everyone wants that cost side instead. Everyone wants to be the recipient of that.
Well, also, never burn any bridges too. I think that's the most important thing you can learn when you're trading, because the most important deal you're going to make is always the next one. So, or the next decision. So never burn any bridges in trade talks either. I found that's a bad way to go, especially if you're in a keeper dynasty league.
It's easy to get caught up in it, and I certainly have been, as someone who makes a lot of trades, and someone who plays in a fantasy baseball league with my father-in-law. so that's something that I've certainly learned. And you know what? People are going to get caught up in it. People are going to get upset, because it is just, that's the nature of these things. But yeah, definitely you always feel better 3 days later when you don't get worked up about it, when you don't get upset about something. So I do think that, again, as you said, is burning bridges, not for any other reason that the more ways you can, the more opportunities you provide yourself to improve your team, the better chance you're going to have at winning.
Absolutely. I think that pretty much sums up everything I wanted to talk about. Jeff, you got anything else that you think is important for fantasy owners that maybe we haven't touched on that you want to share with everyone?
No. To give the sappy answer, the thing I've been thinking about a lot lately over the last couple of years is you got to figure out what you enjoy about fantasy baseball and, you know, get into the kinds of leagues that, and the internet's great that it provides those opportunities that's going to provide that for you. So if you're always upset with your league or with how it's going or, you know, then maybe that's not the thing for you. Or if you want to be upset about your league all the time, well, then that's perfect for you. But I think that we spend a lot of times maybe, and maybe not so much in fantasy baseball, but I see this in other fantasy leagues and other sports I play. You know, people might be participating in things that they don't seem that happy. And so I don't know. That to me is my big one is we should maybe just spend a little bit of that time analyzing, you know, what we're getting out of it.
Awesome stuff. So that's going to do it for our conversation with Jeff Quinton. You can check out his work on Baseball Prospectus. His column is aptly titled The Quinton. It focuses on the fantasy baseball strategy. For my money, you're the best one in the business right now doing this stuff. So just wanted to...
Thank you, George. And for the record, I did not come up with that title. I didn't invent my last name nor the name of the title. So
all that matters is it's good stuff. You can apply it to, I think that's the best thing about it is every time you read the column, you think, man, that's something I can take away that I can apply to my league and my own experiences and improve my process going forward. So that's really what I love most about it. So everybody should go check out Jeff's work. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at JJQ01. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me, George.
All right, so that's going to do it for our conversation with Jeff Quinton. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and wrap things up here on Flags Fly Forever. Welcome back to episode 82 of Flags Fly Forever. This has been a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. I'm George Bissell saying thanks for listening. You can follow all of us on Twitter. Brett Sayer is at Dynasty Guru. Mike Gianella is at Mike Gianella. And you can follow me on Twitter as well at George Bissell. So we're going to be in New York this weekend to record some stuff from Tout Wars. We're going to come back next week and recap all the action. Brett's in the mixed portion. He's told me he's going to buy all of the players. Those are his exact words. And Mike's over on the NL side trying to defend his crown from last year. Some stiff competition in the senior circuit there. All right, so that's going to do it for episode 82 of Flags Fly Forever. I want to thank our guest, Jeff Quinton of BP, once again for coming on. And until the next show, this is George Bissell saying thanks for listening. So long, everybody.